Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi. And welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. This week, I'm thrilled to welcome David Gaunt to the show. David is professor emeritus at Södertörn University in Sweden and has written widely about genocide in Eastern Europe and the Middle East. In particular, he's one of the few people in the world who can claim to have studied the mass violence against the Assyrian, Syriac, and Chaldean peoples of the Ottoman Empire. His first book on the subject, titled Massacres, Resistance, Protectors, Muslim-Christian Relations in Eastern Anatolia in World War I, was a path-breaking investigation of the subject. He's followed that book with an edited volume that examines this violence from a variety of perspectives. The book is co-edited, and I want to make sure to give credit to Nauris Otto and Sauner Bartoma, his co-editors. And together, the three of them have produced a book that widens the angle of vision on the events. It includes history, psychology, memory studies, literature, and other approaches to comparative genocide. And it both adds to our knowledge and suggests paths for future research. It's a fabulous book. I learned a lot from it, and I'm really looking forward to talking about it. So with that, David, welcome, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for this very generous introduction. And I'm very happy to be here.
Great. I always ask guests to start the interview by saying a little bit about themselves. So help us understand who you are and how you ended up becoming interested in the subject.
Right. Well, I have always been a historian, and for a long time, I did a lot of things about population and family history and work history and the history of the Swedish bureaucracy. But at one point, one of my daughters was taking a summer course, and I was on the telephone with her, and I asked her, what was the course? And she said, no, I won't tell you. Uh-huh. I said, and then my wife got on the phone, and after a while she came back and said, well, Siri is taking a summer course on genocide studies at Uppsala University. And I thought, I must have been very unclear about what I felt about genocide and violence in general. So it got me to thinking. And I asked Siri what was the problem, and she said she thought that I would think she was a bit of a silly in a way. And I said, no, it wasn't. And so I started working with my mother's people. They came, they're Jewish from Ukraine, and started working on Eastern Europe because I was connected with a school for Eastern European studies. And, so it began like that. The Assyrian connection came a bit later. You may remember that the Prime Minister of Sweden, Göran Persson, had a series of conferences that began in 2000 on genocide prevention and teaching. And I was there and listened, and somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said he was an Assyrian and wondered if I could be interested in Assyrian things. And I said, well, why not? Because, well, my university, it turns out, on which is new, is smack in the middle of one of the largest diasporas of Assyrian peoples in the world. So it didn't seem like such a silly idea to work with the Assyrian problems. They had difficulties, of course, like anyone who connected with the Ottoman Empire, with the Turkish diplomats who were working here in Stockholm. They needed someone who would represent their case. So I started reading whatever they gave me. And after a while, I could see that this was really very much like the Jewish Holocaust. The way things were, the brutality, the political manipulations, the administrative and policiera things. So I became bitten, we would say. In the end, I ended up writing a book about it. With their help, the Assyrian community helped me a lot, like translating books from Arabic or Syriac into actually Swedish, and then finding things from libraries in Turkey that were not possible to actually get from rather secretive places. We had a network extending from Australia to the Middle East who were working with getting me documents and information. It was quite remarkable, actually. Some of the most reliable of my informants worked as grossists in, the wholesalers in the fruit and vegetable markets.
That's an amazing story.
Well,
I don't know that I've ever heard an origin story like that before.
I haven't done it either, but more than once. For me, it was really something that I like, a labor of love in a way, because they were so helpful to me. I felt that this is a group of people whose history is totally unknown, even among themselves. It was actually first when they had left Turkey in the 1970s and 1980s that they had the possibility to actually study their own history and find things out, because in a way, inside the Republic of Turkey, they're parents often were very suspicious of the teachers in the Turkish schools, and so were not especially keen to have their children go to school. In 1980, there was a coup in Turkey, and a lot of the first Assyrian students were actually in university were very politicized, and they came to Sweden and to Germany. And they began talking about this, what they called SAFO, the Year of the Sword, having to do with the genocide, and made it as part of their identity of their peoples, and working politically, especially on this question. The recognition by other governments, that is.
So this subject was largely unknown, at least in the West. How did people respond to that first book?
I lost a few friends in the meaning that my informants would give me some kind of information and documentation. And then it turned out that there were many sides to the same question. And so I when the book was translated into Turkish, I put in a footnote about what an event that happened in the town of Midyat, which is probably the only totally Assyrian city in the Ottoman Empire. Then I got a telephone call from someone in Minneapolis, I think, and said, "I have read your book. It is terrible. My ancestor did not die in that way, and he was loyal to the Assyrian peoples." And so I changed in the Turkish translation there are two sides to this story. And all of a sudden, some of the people who had been helping me said, "Oh, no, you can't do that. We won't talk to you again." Huh. And little bit like that. I have a feeling that many of the conflicts that were involved in the Assyrian peoples inside the Ottoman Empire and in Turkey have been transported into the diaspora, and they're not solved yet. My co-editor, Nauris Ato, she's written an entire dissertation about the identity conflicts in the diaspora between those who will call themselves Assyrian and those who refuse to call themselves Assyrian, though they belong to the same, what we would call, ethnic religious group. I've learned by making a lot of mistakes.
Well, that's maybe a good opportunity to ask you if you can briefly, Nauris and Soner, they're not with us, Soner, maybe you could introduce them just a little bit.
Well, Nauris is a linguist and a religious researcher, now based in Cambridge, but her dissertation was at Leiden in the Netherlands. She is working now very closely with the Yazidi question. Assyrians and Yazidis have the same sort of background in this, living in the same place and being non-Muslim. Soner is a political scientist, now I think based in Berlin, he grew up in Turkey and had been asked by the HDP political party, the one that is pro-Kurdish, to be their Assyrian candidate at one time, but he felt he could not go back to Turkey stay out of jail. So now he's working as a political scientist.
So let's turn to the book, and I know that this is a subject that many people don't know much about. So maybe you could say a little bit about, just as a way of introducing this, what happened? Who are the peoples you've referred to, the Assyrians, Syriac, and Chaldeans? Where did they live, and what happened to them in this period in and around the First World War?
Well, if we call them ethnically, in a modern term, Assyrians, they include a number of smaller religious groups that call themselves the Syriac Orthodox, the Syriac Catholics, the Chaldeans, which is also a Catholic church, and then the Church of the East, which traditionally was called the Nestorians. They all lived in an area in southeastern part of Turkey, close to the Syrian and the Iraq and the Iranian borders. This is very hilly, sometimes very mountainous and remote areas. We believe that they moved there in this early stages of Christianity because they belonged to the theology of the school of Antioch, which was a little bit special, a lot of very ascetic type of religion. They may have ended up in this area as a way of being free from persecution, even in the Byzantine Empire, and then later on in from various Muslim states. This is mountainous and remote areas, so that this kind of an area is very good for preserving your own culture, being far from any state that will take taxes or press you into anything. But it also meant that these people were, that they may have at one time spoken the same language and have the same kind of religion. They separated and they had little contact with each other, and even were not just rivals, but actually could be hating each other. But they were all what we would say they are Christian in basically. And the religious aspect of their identity is the most important one. This remoteness from the state also meant that they were remote from education, from media, and from the rest of the world until missionaries turned up there in the 1800s. What can one say? They lived as farmers or semi-nomads up in the high mountains with their flocks of sheep, and they were surrounded by neighbors who were Kurds or Yazidis, which is, they are Kurdish speaking but have a non-Muslim religion. Some of them were so, the Assyrians were so fierce that you really couldn't tell the difference between them and the Kurds except by the hats that they were wearing. They had a culture that was based on family feuds, blood feuds, etc. They were very good at defending themselves. Some of the Assyrian, the Nestorians, the ones that lived furthest towards Iran, were actually built up as tribes, and they could carry weapons even though they were not Muslims. They belonged to Kurdish tribal confederations, and sometimes they would, the ones in the one confederation would be fighting the co-religionists in another confederation. So it's all very messy as to their past, and a rather aggressive people in a way, which is what happened during the genocide. The genocide started in 1915. In the area along the border between Turkey and Iran, when one of the leaders of the Ottoman government, Talat Pasha, the Minister of Interior, decided that he was going to move the Assyrians from the border area and bring them about 1,000 miles westward, and divide them up so that there wouldn't be very many people in any particular village, and so their culture would be destroyed and the like. And this happened just the week before the First World War broke out in this area. So it didn't get implemented, but instead the local Kurdish irregular regiments began massacring Assyrian people in order to get them to flee across the border into Iran. And then this was already in 1914. I don't know if I can go into the genocide in great detail.
Well, let's take a second and back. So that was a wonderful introduction. One of the things that you highlight in your essay in the book, and also in the introduction, is the lengthy history of violence in the region that precedes World War I. What was that violence about, and was it qualitatively different from, how was it qualitatively different from what happens during the war itself?
Okay, yeah. This is one of my hobby horses that the Assyrians were caught up in Kurdish tribal warfare, which became more and more intense as the 1800s progressed. In the beginning, you could say that the Assyrians would give the Kurds as good a fight as possible, and they were sort of balanced in this way. But there were several phases, and at one time, one of the Kurdish emirs decided that he wanted to expand and come into a larger territory and take over smaller emirates. And usually these emirates, based around the Tigris River, I guess you would say, would spill over into the Assyrian areas, either into the mountains or the farmlands of the Turabdin, as it was called, an area filled with Assyrian villages. And this led to massacres in the 1840s that already came to the knowledge of the world press. So they were writing about it in the Times of London, even in French, Russian newspapers had articles on this. And this sort of continued after a while. One of the steps that were most fateful for the Assyrians was that the Ottoman state decided it wanted to centralize its power and send in armies to put down these emirs who were getting a bit restless. And when these armies came in, they created more trouble than there was even before. It was sort of like the Americans in Iraq, and the Christians were caught up in this. And they were more or less on the losing end, even here. At one time, the Sultan, whose name was Abdul Hamid, almost the next to the last Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, decided to make a deal with the Kurdish emirs and turn certain of his more friendly Kurdish tribes into a special irregular regiments of cavalry, gave them uniforms and weapons and the like. And these regiments were totally out of control. As irregulars, they were not subject to military discipline, and as a military, they were not subject to normal Ottoman justice, and so they could do anything they wanted to, stealing. The Assyrians were good at fighting, and the like, but they were being outnumbered, they were being outgunned, and it made even normal, ordinary Assyrians very watchful. They could be attacked at any time without notice. They had to be themselves armed and be prepared to defend themselves. If they couldn't carry arms, they had to ally themselves with Kurdish tribes. And this got them involved in Kurdish intertribal warfare, of which there is a long history. And this created a culture of violence. I mean, when you look at the history of the Assyrians, what is written, they are praising warriors and even religious figures who could dare to stand up against the Kurdish neighbors. Like, so the whole, it was like a powder keg. Now, what happens that makes a difference during the First World War is that the state actually supports the Kurdish and local people in their fights and grudges against the Christian peoples. This didn't occur previously. Usually the Kurds would try and eliminate the Christians. There were also imams who had an extremely negative view of the Christians. But the state would try to help them, preserve them, send an army or send soldiers. This did not happen during World War One. Instead, they encouraged the Kurds to do this. And even if the Kurdish leader said that, no, no, these are our Christians, we'll try and defend them against these other guys. But we've always defended them. No, 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 the state said, we will punish you if you do that. And that did happen. The state would organize even special task forces that would go and massacre villages. There were episodes in which Kurdish bandits, which were already banished, would get a pardon in case they would participate in the killings. This was more than an explosive. It was really a catastrophe.
So you make a point in the book of explaining why you believe genocide is the right term for these events. Can you run through that for the listeners? Why is this genocide?
Okay. All right. I'm taking as my starting point that genocide is an activity that is politically determined and is made by a government against a minority that is identifiable for religious or linguistic purposes, and trying to eradicate them as much as possible. The genocide starts with an order that comes from Talat Pasha, the Minister of Interior, on the 26th of October 1914, that the Assyrians would be moved from their homes and sent to Ankara or Konya or other places in the interior of Turkey. And then it ends on the 25th of December 1915 with a new order from Talat Pasha saying that no, what we have done against the Assyrians up to now, we must stop. But by that time, an estimated 250,000 Assyrians of the various religious groups had been killed, either murdered or died in hardship or disease. And it's said to be about half of the original population. So we have orders coming from above. We can see how the governors in the various provinces organized killing, had administrative personnel who refused to participate in the killing removed and replaced by those who were willing to execute these plans. We can see that all the deportations and the death marches are organized by the chiefs of police, political personalities from the various political organizations were involved, and And sometimes when there was resistance, as the Assyrians did do, you would send the Ottoman army to actually kill and remove people. So in this way, it's totally different. The political aspect is massive, which is why I would call it a genocide rather than simply massacres, and not unfortunate incidents or something like that. And Turkish state has for a long time said that no, this were Kurdish tribes who were out of control who were doing this, but there is so much evidence that is not just the Kurdish tribes who are involved.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that because there's a couple essays in your book about the Turkish response in the past decades, and I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about that. Most people, if they know something about the Ottoman Empire and mass violence in the war, they're going to think about the violence against Armenians. So how does this violence compare with that directed against the Armenians? And is this a distinction that the Ottoman government makes, or does the Ottoman government lump the Armenians and the Assyrians together?
No, this is the most complicated aspect of it all. It would seem that in the beginning, the Ottoman state was only interested in the Armenians because they were politically organized. They had a revolutionary movement and were very effective and had a great network. The Assyrians lived sort of in a different geographic area, were not political, and had no revolutionary movement at all to speak of. So it would seem to be on the local initiative that if you lived in a province where there weren't very many Armenians, but there were Assyrians there, you would attack them. For many people in Kurdish would say that this was a firman anfela, that is to say, an order from the Sultan to kill Christians, fella being the word for Christians, and you would do this indiscriminately, and the political administrations of, say, in Diyarbakir and Bitlis and in Van cooperated in this as local initiative because you wanted to take over property. You also had a religious personality saying that it is a good thing to kill non-Muslims and the like. But we cannot see actually how it came that Assyrians were mixed up with the Armenians. Everyone knew that they spoke a different language for the most part, that their religion was different. And that they lived in different places. But it did seem in a way, and the Assyrians at the time stated that, well, we are being killed because we are Christian, not because we are political. We can't get much further than that.
So let me follow up on that last comment, because I'm intrigued by how the victims understood what was happening to them. Did they see this as something distinctly different from what their parents and grandparents experienced? Did they understand genocide as a word didn't exist? Did they understand this as an attempt to eliminate a people? What's your sense of how people suffering from this violence experienced it?
In general, in genocide, the victims themselves actually don't know what's going on. Whether it's a genocide or not is a reconstruction that you make. Okay, what was it that happened to us? Was it so systematic? Was it, and we have a number of people who were writing diaries or chronicles at the same time. And in some cases, if they were religiously inspired, they would say, well, we're being killed because we as a people have sinned against our God. So this is a punishment coming from God. That is something that doesn't help you to understand, actually. Others would say, well, it's like in Roman times. It's the Christians thrown to the beasts. They usually did not know very much about politics. They could say something like, well, the Sultan has ordered this to happen. How do we know that? Because our Kurdish neighbors have said that the Sultan has sent this order. So in the beginning, they had no term for this. The term Sapho, this year of the sword, is something that has come up in the last 30 to 40 years. And that's a word that was usually used for any kind of massacre. Now it's become Sapho with a big S, the Sapho. Otherwise, there are many words for massacre, for deportations, and the like that Shabotalai in our book was writing about, how people were using that. Sapho seems to be catching on even among comparative genocide studies. So it is a politically inspired word that has been used in the diaspora.
One of the distinctive aspects of this violence is that it doesn't end in 19. How does the extension of violence in the Ottoman Empire as a whole shape the violence against the Christians, and when does it stop?
It stops in a geographic area that we know of as Tur Abdin, that is the area around the market town of Midyat, which was about the only enclave of Christian Assyrians that existed in the Republic of Turkey after the deportations and the genocide. It ends in the 1970s, 80s. Then it is not state directed, but it is directed by against Assyrians individually or in groups. Small buses with people being taken to churches or to town would be surrounded and the people killed, or individual leaders would be picked off one by one. And this contributed to the exodus of the Assyrian Christians from the area in the 1970s, 1980s, taking advantage of that Germany had this program for Gastarbeiter. So they would be coming to Germany and then to Holland and to Sweden in a wave. And now there are only a few hundred left. And their description is that the genocide never stopped. It just continued. And this is their view. We can also say that the Syrian Orthodox Church, which was based in Mardin, a rather big town in southern Turkey, tried to make an accommodation with the new government of Turkey, Kemal Atatürk and the like, saying that, no, well, the genocide didn't happen to us, so we're okay. We love Turks. We love the new government. They were thrown out anyway in 1924 and ended up in Syria. We don't really know why Ataturk did this. Other than it's some kind of a primitive feeling that a new nation needs to be homogeneous, which was okay, pretty common at that period of time. It's also not Nazi time. Locally, people were killing prominent Assyrians who were known to have led a resistance and the like. So the more prominent you were, the greater the risk was that you would be picked off and shot. It's really a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing that it never got settled up, and that the Turkish state's police system, which otherwise is rather well known for being effective, did not stop this violence.
You referred earlier to Turkey's consistent insistence that there was no genocide against Christian peoples during the war. And there's a couple essays in the book outlining why and how the Turkish government has tried to deny that the events that you're writing about constitute genocide. What is the motive for the Turk? What do you see as the motive for the Turkish government? And what arguments does the government use in their effort to deny this?
This is also a difficult question because we're trying to figure out why they are denying something that actually happened, and where there is a multitude of documentation in the Ottoman archives themselves. It seems that they have painted themselves in a corner by denying over such a long period of time. That after a while, the denial is simply a continuation of the denial, and you don't have to have a newer argument inside this. There's an interesting book by Fatma Mürge Gürçek on Turkish denialism. It started already in the 1700s, that when an accusation that they had been there had been systematic killings of non-Muslims, and saying that no, it hadn't happened. I think it's getting less and less aggressive, this denialism. It used to be that the Turkish diplomats would be sent to conferences in order to make this make a counter statement, they've ceased doing that. I really don't know. After I wrote the first book, the Turkish Historical Commission actually instituted an Assyrian section for the denial. It's a one person deal. It's exactly the same as the denialism against the Armenians. I'm flabbergasted that they actually do this. I'm sure that all of the diplomats who were involved were very embarrassed in having to do this. But yeah, I have no explanation. I do not know.
Well, some broader questions about this. How does what we now know about these events and this genocide, does this change at all our understanding of the broader nature of the Ottoman regime, of the Committee of Union and Progress, how does this shape our understanding of the broader context?
Well, I mean, you can write the history of Turkey without even mentioning genocide at all. On the other hand, if you take the genocide as something central, something that was being built up throughout the 1800s to 1915 and then beyond, then it's something else. Turkey described in its history as a progressive thing, without genocide is a story of successes. If you bring in all of these massacres and the treatment of the minorities, including the Yazidis, then it's not a story of success. It's a story of cyclical abuse of people and a very harsh regime that has some liberal aspects sometimes, but rather harsh in its essence. Whether the one or the other is actually the more truthful, I wouldn't say, but the Assyrians would definitely say that their persecution has been long-term and ongoing. And
I should say, and we don't have time to talk about it in this interview, but one of the essays in the volume is about the long-term impact, both on people who survived the massacres, but also on the second and third generation. And it's well worth looking at that essay in terms of thinking about the long-term impact of this violence. Let me flip the past question around then. What is looking at the genocide against the Assyrian people, what does this add to our understanding, broadly to our understanding of mass violence and genocide?
It gives us a case to consider when doing work with comparing genocides with each other. The problem with the genocide comparison thing is that we haven't had very many actual genocides, but this is one more. It is one that is difficult in a way because it is not politically motivated. It is sort of like the situation of the Roma who died during the Nazi Holocaust, although Hitler never said a word about them. That's on the one side. The other side is the difficult question is that the Assyrians put up a lot of resistance, and when they had a chance, they took bloody revenge on those they thought were the perpetrators. This means that we have a situation where we can't really portray the Assyrians as innocent victims, which we usually like to do in a genocide narrative. Here we have a group that is just as fierce as those who have attacked them. That's an interesting thing, and genocide usually cannot work with something like that. And it has allowed the Turks at sometimes to say, well, since they resisted and helped the enemy, then they deserved everything they got.
So let me flip that question around. What does looking at this particular event add to our understanding of mass violence and genocide?
Well, to my mind, it has a great bearing for comparative genocide. Now, in the Assyrian case, we're talking about a people who make a great amount of resistance. They even are fighting against the Turkish army and sometimes succeeding in this. This makes it difficult to portray the Assyrian case as one of a completely innocent victims who are the victims of completely evil perpetrators. Sometimes when the resistance goes so far that they start killing disproportionately many of the group that they consider to be the perpetrators, it still does not negate the question of the issue of being a genocide, but it makes it more difficult to see what kind of victims they are. That, I think, is something interesting. Also, this is like a parallel to the case of the Roma during the Second World War, who were being killed, although Hitler never said a word about them. Now we have the Assyrian groups, which were being killed, although they had no political importance whatsoever, and nothing on the same level as the Armenians. So is this a secondary genocide, or what is it?